This is Claire Dunn, Jung, Wounded Healer of the Soul, June 15th, 2012. This was recorded on DVD. There were a few images in the DVD.
So I'm delighted to see so many people have turned up and at such short notice. Thank you so much for coming. We're actually here originally because Jerry Wenstrom and Marilyn advised the Seattle people that I was coming, and marvelously, they've risen to the occasion and put on a special evening. So it's lovely to be here. Now, I should tell you about me, just a little bit of background, because it's kind of necessary to know this. When I first turned up with my manuscript to Parabola some years ago, Joe Kulin, who was the executive publisher, said to me, "Are you an analyst?" And I said, "No." And he said, "Are you a Jungian?" And I said, "No." Then he said, "Why are you writing about Jung?" So I have written a book on Australia's first saint, and nobody ever asked me whether I was a saint. So, you know, and I'm not. but there's an Irish story, you know. Often these little stories encapsulate something of life. And there is a true Irish story of an American who was in Connemara, which is mountains, rivers and streams in one of the magic areas of Ireland, which is where I come from. And he was talking to an old farmer over the stone walls that they have all over Connemara. So he's talking to him for a while, and then he said to him, "Have you lived here all your life?" And the farmer said, "I don't know yet." So, you know, this is someone who had a sense of life unfolding. And I think that certainly could be said of how I've come to Jung and am living such a long chapter of my life with him. So I first actually met him in my late 20s when I read Memories, Dreams, Reflections. And I was immediately taken by two things in that book, which stayed with me all the way through the writing of it. The first one is, he said, the psyche is by nature religious. And I hadn't paid any attention to psychology up to then, so that kind of got me in. And then the second one was, he talked quite a lot in the book about two personalities operating within himself, which he had to a marked degree, but which we all have to some extent. And that is what he called personality number two, that which we are by nature. And personality number one, that which we become to fit in with our family, our social milieu, the circumstances of our lives, the spirit of our times. And sometimes they're out of kilter with each other. So it's bringing them together is an essence of Jung's work. So I understood both of those things personally from my own life. I was then doing radio and television work in Sydney. And I've done many things because I'm not actually trained to do anything. So I've done many things, you see. And so here I was on television doing the weather as a weather announcer. And at the same time, that was my external self. And at the same time, my internal self was reading books like Autobiography of a Yogi, The Rise and Fall of the Third Reich, The Varieties of Religious Experience by William James. So there was a difference between the two elements of myself. And I think that over the years, what's happened is my inner interests and my outer skills increased by each job that I did, and over time they've more or less come together. So that's a short explanation of me. But I also at the time read Man and His Symbols, and that was at a time when I was going through a very stagnant period in my own life. Everything seemed to have stopped. So I decided while reading Man and His Symbols that maybe something was going on underneath what was going on. And I decided to trust that. So they're my initial connections with Jung. And, of course, that's through the two books that were intended for the general public, the only two that he produced for the general public. Not for a while. Now, what I actually set out to do with Jung, I originally intended to do a documentary to match one that I had done on Freud. And I wanted to make Jung accessible. I'd been talking to people who'd say, oh, he's obscure and he's difficult, and I think you must be the one I'm writing this for. Because that was my principal thing. I wanted to make him accessible to... If I didn't understand it, then nobody else would. So it was accessible to people like me, if you like. And I also wanted to use his own words. I wanted him to tell his own story. And I found in doing the research that in his letters, his personality is there in spades. And also the nub of his ideas, because he used his letters to communicate the nub of his ideas more and more as he went on in life. So that was a principal way of getting the color and flavor and salt of his personality through to people, get him to explain himself and also talk about the ideas in his work that were in the letters. I then used part of his later works, in particular, where he, the deepest of his works. I found wonderful books of reminiscences by people who knew him, who were colleagues or patients or friends. And I also, of course, used Memories, Dreams, Reflections, his autobiographical book, for the public. So it's a, the book is really a combination of all those sorts of things. And I wanted to present it in such a way that people would make up their own minds. I didn't want to tell people what to think. Now, obviously, because I'm in control of what material goes in, there's a certain amount of what I've selected does give a bias to that extent. But I hope that I've done it in such a way that I've just presented the material as such and then left it for others to understand in whatever way they picked it up. So they were my intentions. Now, having said all of that, I didn't ever become a Jungian. And it's just as well, because he wasn't one either. He was Jung. So why be a second-class Jung if I can be an original me? And he said it himself, and he said it repeatedly in his works, in different forms. He said, I do not want anyone to be a Jungian. I want people, above all, to be themselves. Should I be found one day only to have created another ism, then I will have failed in everything I tried to do. So you could then ask the question, why look to him at all then, now 51 years after his death? But I think it's this very authenticity of him in his life and his work is the thing that we can look to, because Jung had to learn to be what he was. It didn't happen easily, and it didn't come over a short period of time. It went over many, many years of his life. And he says of himself at the age of 84, having found the courage to live himself out by that stage, the journey from cloud cuckoo land to reality lasted a long time. In my case, Pilgrim's Progress consisted in my having to climb down 1,000 ladders until I could reach out my hand to the little clod of earth that I am. And he also said of himself, my life has been, in a sense, the quintessence of what I have written, not the other way round. The way I am and the way I write are a unity. All my ideas and all my endeavors are myself. So Jung had this, everything he wrote, he experienced himself first. And that's this authentic quality that comes right through his work when you start researching it. So tonight I thought it might be worthwhile just to remind ourselves of some of the things Jung was in his life and his work, and to see how that shows up in the central messages of his work. And then most importantly, to see how that resonates with us personally, if there are things that we feel that we can identify with or that are part of our own lives, just keep it at the back of your minds as we're going through, and then maybe later on somebody might like to make a statement about it. So it's not just something out there, it's something that we resonate with ourselves. So that Jung's work is essentially spiritual, he attests to himself. He said, "The main interest of my work is not concerned with the treatment of neurosis, but rather with the approach to the numinous, which is the real therapy." And there are four key elements of his teaching. One, we need to become our complete selves to live as whole human beings. Two, the complete or whole self lives naturally in two levels or worlds, an outer earth-rooted material level and an inner spiritually centered one. Three, the spiritual source of life needs humanity to mirror its creation in consciousness and help evolve it further. And four, the whole human being is open to the divine as co-creator. So as a human being, Jung, by all accounts, was indeed the best example of his own teaching. And there's an Israeli writer, Eric Neumann, who has left this account of him. He'd worked with Jung as a student and then became a writer in his own right. And he said, "Encountering in a man, with all his weaknesses and in all his greatness, that which is greater than man, and in which nevertheless everything human is rooted, was for me a decisive and direction-setting experience." Now, when Jung was around 50, he assessed himself to a woman who had sent a not-too-good portrait of him that she painted. And he said, "My exterior," he wrote to her, "is in strange contrast to my spirit. When I am dead, nobody will think that this is the corpse of one with spiritual aspirations. I am the clash of opposites. That's what makes it frightfully difficult to get me right." And there's an American analyst from San Francisco, Jane Wheelwright, and she's written wonderful accounts of Jung, and she sees him very clearly. She was in analysis with him in the 1930s. And she's written of him, "Jung was a mountain of a man, big enough to encompass every kind of person imaginable. All kinds of people, big and small, found through him their uniqueness. He touched all kinds of people who came his way. Sometimes it was through what he inadvertently said, more often than not, something he would not remember. Sometimes it was what he did. Mostly it was what he was. A comprehensive, large, all-embracing, complete man. He spanned in himself everything from greatness and power to all too human failings. He could be irritable and sometimes downright demanding. Explosions of rage were not uncommon. He even could be duped at times by unscrupulous, ambitious people. Sometimes he seemed to reduce to human ordinariness. At other times, he seemed to expand, to literally expand physically to overpowering size. I remember once experiencing him like this. I must have betrayed my feeling that he was out of my reach because he said out of the blue, 'Do I have horns on my head?' So Jung was able to constellate the unconscious of countless numbers and kinds of people. It was an extraordinary gift that he had. So let's start on a little journey through Jung's life. And I want to tell you that the book is in three parts. And the first part is called Wounded. And we've symbolized it with this portrait of Francesco Clemente, which is a self-portrait. So this part of the book takes us to about the age of mid-40s. So we start off now with Jung. Born in 1875 in a small village in Switzerland, and he was a hypersensitive, nature-loving, intuitive child who played alone and dreamt deep direction-setting dreams that he didn't understand at the time and certainly could not tell anybody in the stifling emotional and religious atmospheres into which he was brought. But he claimed later that he credited them with shaping the creative and spiritual patterns of his life. And then we have number one and number two personalities in him with this painting by Robert Graves, that which I mentioned before, that which we are by nature, and that which we become to fit in with our family and social milieu. So now here's this child around the age of 10, and he had a thought experience in broad daylight on the way home from school, and it was an experience that frightened him to let the thought through, and it took him about 3 days to let the thought come through, because his thought was that God had released an enormous turd on the cathedral roof, smashing it. And he said out of that came, just allowing the thought through had a liberating effect on him, while at the same time he had a dim understanding that God could be something terrible. And he said this, he had experienced a deep and dark, terrible secret that overshadowed his life. And we'll come back to some of that later. So now, just to take a quick run through the early stages of his life, we have him with personality number one dominating from about that age of about 10, and through to the late 30s, he went through his studies. He graduated, specializing in the then despised area of psychiatry. He married Emma Rauschenbach. They had 5 children together. He had a very successful career. He was a supporter of the pioneering Sigmund Freud. And there was an intense relationship between the two, most of it by correspondence. But when they first met, they actually talked nonstop for 13 hours. So this, there was a mounting clash of ideas between them as Jung moved into deepening areas of realization. And this, you could say, was a meeting of complementary opposites at first and then becoming antagonistic in time. So in 1913, there was a complete breakdown of the relationship. And there was then a breakdown period in Jung himself. And this was, following the split with Freud, this was a breaking down of intellectual dominance to allow in experience of the deeper natural layers of the psyche. And this came to him in ways that seemed quite frightening to him. It included prophetic dreams, inner voices, visions. There was inner guidance in the form of Philemon, and he's characterized this in this painting, which is his own painting called Shadow Cornered. And again, we'll come back to shadow in terms of Jung a little bit later on. So there was outer help while all of this was happening in the form of Tony Wolfe, who was a former patient, a lyric poet, and who loved him and supported him through this discombobulating period, while introducing him to Eastern modes of thought, which helped give him a context for what was happening to him. And she remained in parallel relationship with Jung for 40 years of his married life. So Jung has recorded all of this in the Red Book. And many of you, I'm sure, will have heard about the Red Book, which was published for the first time in 2009. So this, it's the breaking down of the old context in which we hold our sense of I, and a breaking through into a larger sense of ourselves, so that we're walking in larger shoes. So it started with a vision at the end of 1913, and again, it was a waking vision in a train, which was repeated several times over the next few months. And the vision was of Europe and blood and devastation over Europe. And he said, I felt as if my mind had gone crazy. In the Red Book, he tells that in the middle of 1914, when World War I started, he felt a sense of relief for himself because he recognized he'd had a prophetic vision or a series of prophetic visions, and that that's what they were pointing to. So also in the Red Book, you've got a fair amount of time where he talks between the spirit of the times and the spirit of the depths. So the spirit of the times, which changes with the times, and the spirit of the depths, which is like the deep levels of the sea coming up before it becomes the wave of the times. And these two spirit inner voices dialogued with him. And he began to get a very strong sense that the message he was carrying was of an immanent God, a God that was in everything, big and small, dark and light. There was also paradox absolutely implicit in these levels of life. And there's one phrase that you can pick that demonstrates it. If you marry the ordered to chaos, you produce the divine child. So here you've got the two opposites, and the carrying forward point is getting the balance in between the two. So holding this opposites together and getting the balance again is key Jungian work. Then there was a feminine soul voice, what he later called the anima, which argued with him to recognize his own opposites and develop the feminine receiving mode within himself instead of the intellectual dominance that had been there from about the age of 10 onwards. He had an inner guide, Philemon, who taught him a great deal. And it was Philemon who articulated the seven sermons to the dead, which Jung later published as a book on its own, but was not included in his collected works by his own request. But it is part of the Red Book. And this is a Gnostic creation myth in which he talks about the unmanifest source in which is nothing and everything. And the mythological image, Abraxas, is the first level of manifestation, and he embodies improbable probability, unreal reality, force, duration, and change all in one. So, Seven Sermons to the Dead outlines in a rather archaic poetic style the skeleton of Jung's most essential ideas, including the conflict of opposites and the concept of individuation. And I thought you might like to hear the lead-up of how this book actually came through to him. So initially it involved the whole Jung household. He said, around 5 o'clock in the afternoon on Sunday, the front doorbell began ringing frantically. It was a bright summer day. Two maids were in the kitchen, from which the open square outside the front door could be seen. Everyone immediately looked to see who was there, but there was no one in sight. I was sitting near the doorbell and not only heard it, but saw it moving. We all simply stared at one another. The atmosphere was thick, believe me. Then I knew something had to happen. The whole house was filled as if there were a crowd present, crammed full of spirits. They were packed right up to the door, and the air was so thick it was scarcely possible to breathe. As for myself, I was all a quiver with the question, for God's sake, what in the world is this? Then they cried out in chorus, we have come back from Jerusalem, where we found not what we sought. And that's the first sentence of Seven Sermons to the Dead. Then it began to flow out of me, and in the course of 3 evenings, the thing was written. As soon as I took up the pen, the whole ghostly assemblage evaporated. The haunting was over. These conversations with the dead formed a kind of prelude to what I had to communicate to the world about the unconscious, a kind of pattern of order and interpretation of its general contents. So Abraxas could be said to be the archetype that worked through Jung. And this period of life was a rite of passage that I call initiation number one. And this formed the vehicle through which he worked for the next decades. And I want to read a very brief thing that he has said in the Red Book. At an early stage of these experiences, the knowledge of death came to me that night. I went into the inner death and saw that outer death, outer dying, is better than inner death. And I decided to die outside and live within. I turned away and sought the place of the inner life. So out of the experiences of that time, which included a great deal of emotional turmoil and physically disturbing symptoms, he said, This gave him the raw material with which he worked and grappled and then brought through as his work. And he said, it has taken me virtually 45 years to distill within the vessel of my scientific work the things I experienced and wrote down at that time. And the emergence period began in 1916. He saw an image of this mandala and then a series of mandalas afterwards. And I've seen the original of this, which is just a rough sketch. And this is the final painting that he made of it. It's the evolution of the human being from earth to spirit at the top to the divine child and the cosmic patterns from east to west. So it's a microcosm of the macrocosm. And he called it Systema Monditatis. So it's the self-complete and in relation to the universe. So that takes us to the end of the wounding, part one. And we go into part two of the book, which I called Healer, with another painting of Jung's. This painting, Bow to Creativity, which is also from the Red Book. So in this period, now in his 50s and 60s, we have Jung in his creative middle years. He traveled to Africa. He came here to America in Taos in New Mexico. And it was in these kinds of territories that he learned the importance of living from the heart and not from the head. He also learned the all importance of consciousness and of consciousness reflecting back creation to its source. And again, it dawned on him that humanity's role was as co-creators of the world. So, back in Europe, he decided to build himself a second retreat, and he built Bollingen, like a fairy tale castle over long periods of years. That's Jung himself, of course, with the pipe sticking out of his mouth. And he lived there without electricity. Running water, no. That came from a well, and he cooked his own meals. He said these simple acts keep men simple. And he said of Bollingen that it was his place of solitude and repose, where I am most deeply myself, the age-old son of the mother, personality number two, who exists outside time. There I see life in the round as something forever coming into being and passing on. So these were also the years when mythology that arise from the archetypes and the archetypes together as the collective unconscious clarified as concepts and linked together in his mind. It was also the time when he found outer parallels to his thinking with the Christian Gnostics from the early stages of Christianity, with the alchemists of the medieval times, and then there was an esoteric Chinese manuscript that was sent to him called The Secret of the Golden Flower. And this was a manuscript which he said brought him undreamed of confirmation of his ideas. So in this, what we're beginning to see is the pattern of Jung, that he learned, first of all, through his own experience. Then he learned through the experiences of his patients. Then he looked to worldwide cultures and to philosophies right through the ages, and this brought him into a universal sense of humanity. So Jung is the first, or one of the first, universalists. Now, he said that all of these states of awareness, which he reached in himself, came, he said, through what all cultures, right down to the most primitive level, call the way of initiation. And he described individuation as the experience of a natural law, an inner self-regulating, maturing process by which a person becomes a whole human being, acknowledging and living the total range of himself. And in the process, the ego I is ultimately faced with something larger than itself, a force within to which it yields and serves. So the human being just then recognizes itself as both material and spiritual, conscious and unconscious. And it is, in fact, a spiritual initiation leading to a higher level of consciousness. So individuation, Jung said, does not only mean that man has become truly human, as distinct from animal, but that he has become partially divine as well. This means practically that he becomes adult, responsible for his existence, knowing that he does not only depend on God, but that God also depends on man. So the individuation process is the core of his psychology, and with this, Jung mapped the psyche, outlining the natural psychological path to the spiritual core. And he said that we live in a large apartment building, and we're living on only one or two levels of our conscious selves, our minds forgetting the rest, and that the individuation process is introducing us to the rest. And depending on what we find, some of the rooms have to be cleaned out a bit, some of them have to have a bit more furniture put in them, some of them have to have the furniture taken out, and so that it's balanced out into a harmonious whole. So the first step along this way of individuation, the one closest to our day-to-day selves, is what Jung called the shadow. So we're back to the shadow again. And this shadow is a call to explore our lives in greater depth, and bringing that into light and dealing with its contents, whatever they may be. And so you can look at that and say, the shadow is things that we don't know about ourselves, that we don't like about ourselves, that we don't want to know about ourselves, and more importantly, what we often project onto other people that we dislike. And then there's the other side of the shadow, because with Jung, there's always both sides of things. He really had got this breath of life well under control. The other side of the shadow is the positive aspects of it, the gifts and qualities in ourselves that we are being called on to develop and have not yet brought forth. And this, again, helps us to live in larger shoes, in larger size of ourselves. And it all helps us to grow into a larger sense of our humanity. And as always, he knew about the shadow personally. And in this letter, he wrote, "My shadow is indeed so huge, I could not possibly overlook it in the plan of my life. In fact, I had to see it as an essential part of my personality, accept the consequences of this realization, and take responsibility for them. Many bitter circumstances have forced me to see that though the sin one has committed or is can be regretted, it is not cancelled out. I do not believe in the tiger who was finally converted to vegetarianism and ate only apples. My solace was always St. Paul, who did not deem it beneath his dignity to admit he bore a thorn in the flesh." And he said, "I would hardly have been able to form the concept of the shadow had not its existence become one of my greatest experiences, not just with regard to other people, but with regard to myself. But as Jung said in a letter, recognizing the shadow is what I call the apprenticeship, but making out with the anima is what I call the masterpiece that not many bring off. So this next meeting with the opposites in ourselves is the man who experiences the woman inside himself, the soul image in a man, which is represented in dreams, fantasies, or relationship with a woman. And this feminine feeling was not uncomplex in Jung's own life, because in his early days... we've just gone on a little bit. That's all right. In the early days, he, with his mother, who was a loving mother, who at times disappeared into hospital and left him alone or with others taking care of him, this gave him a sense of distrust in women, which later in his life he reversed. And it was the same with men. He had a good relationship with his father, who he felt was powerless, and he reversed his image of men later from experience when he realized that there were things that he could distrust in men. So he's had both ends of the experience of the psyche in this. And then, of course, he had two women in his life, Emma and Toni Wolff, over a period of 40 years. And I have in the book collected all the statements that each of the three have said about each other at one time or another, so you'll find that in the book. There was another thing about him too. Many people, like Jane Wheelwright, found him to be a patriarch of his time. But at the same time that he was being a patriarch, he had the ability to draw out from people their inner selves. So many of the women around him, for instance, became analysts. His wife became an analyst. Toni Wolff became an analyst. Marie-Louise von Franz, Anielle Jaffe. There were a number who brought out this aspect of themselves in this kind of patriarchal outer meeting with Jung. And there was one woman who said he had a genius for talking to the person in me that did not want to come out and to bring it out. So the whole point about the this in a woman, by the way, the animus, of course, is the male image and is the creative spiritual force in a woman, and it's we. Yeah, that's the anima. We're back to the anima. And the next one then is the animus figure. That's from Bamberg Cathedral. And it's the, of course, it's the green man, spirit man. So bringing the two together in the one person is the aim of this stage of this masterpiece stage of the individuation process. And I've heard Native Americans, when they're talking about this, and they talk about a she-man, and they talk about a man-she. So it's the same basic concept from a very different culture. Now, although Jung characterized individuation as a natural self-regulating growth, he didn't necessarily see its progression as easy. And this is a letter, there are about three or four key ones that I would not like to have done the book without, and this is one. And I've seen this hanging on people's fridge doors. There is no place where those striving after consciousness could find absolute safety. Doubt and insecurity are indispensable components of a complete life. Only those who can lose this life really can gain it. A complete life does not consist of a theoretical completeness, but in the fact that one accepts without reservation the particular fatal tissue in which one finds oneself embedded, and that one tries to create a sense of it, to make sense of it, or create a cosmos from the chaotic mess into which one is born. If one lives properly and completely, time and again, one will be confronted with a situation of which one will say, "This is too much. I cannot bear it anymore." Then the question must be answered, can one really not bear it? So pioneering depth psychologist Jung was the first to recognize that if you go deeply enough into the psyche, you meet the spiritual. That phrase that I picked up from his autobiography, the psyche is by nature religious. And we've characterized this by a painting from the Sistine Chapel in the Vatican in Rome from the 16th century. So this capital S self that we meet is a force within to which the ego yields and serves. And it means man becoming whole or complete, truly human, partially divine, human depending on man, on God, and God also depending on man. And Jung wrote, "I call this unknowable, the self. The encounter with the self is a centering which brings about the completion of the individuation process." And he also said, "The self is something unknowable, which is endowed with the highest intensity." And elsewhere he has called the self God in us. So once this takes place, the ego finds itself in a very different position. It's not the center of everything, and it's one in which it's in service. Everything essential, Jung said, happens in the self, and the ego functions as a receiver, spectator, and transmitter. And it's this self which gives the ego inner power for the creative renewal of life. But Jung always, because he was earth-rooted and spiritually centered, if ever anybody was, he always insists on the necessity to maintain a balance between inner and outer life. "If one can stay in the middle," he wrote, "no one is human. Relate to both the God and the animal of the God, one is all right. One must remember, over the animal is the God. With the God is the God's animal." And in the uncertainties of our time, I guess it's more important than ever to hold the eye of the cyclone, this center that's the only real security that we have. So this takes us to part three of the book, which I have called Of the Soul. Now, Jung kept growing all his life, especially in old age. And you can see that in some of the letters, particularly in the letters between Freud and Jung, where you can really hear him struggling to become his own man and to bring his own ideas forth while still having this intense relationship with Freud. So you can see this growth in him. And one of the things that really propelled the growth further was a near-death experience that he had at the age of 69. And I call this initiation number two. And almost half of my book is taken up with the period from 69 to his death at 85. And this, I think, is the period of his life that is least investigated. And I remember talking to a friend of mine in Sydney who was a Freudian professor of psychiatry, and he had used the tapes of my program on Freud at the university, so he wanted to know what was I doing now. And I said, "Well, I'm doing something on Jung." And he said, Jung. He did some good things in the beginning, but he went a bit funny in the end. And I thought, but it's the funny bits I'm interested in. And it's the funny bits that actually grew this project, because I didn't start out to write a book. I started out to do a radio documentary, and it kept getting longer. And by the time I got to this stage of his life, it just got longer and longer. I thought, no, there are three parts to this, and I can't leave out this material to be true to the man or true to his work. So I just went on with it without having a specific format in mind, and it became a book. And people used to say to me at times, well, what are you doing over there? Because it was like 2.5 years of solid work. And I'd say, oh, well, now I've got him to 15. And they'd say, oh, and then I'd say, oh, I've got him to 30. And then by the time I got to 69, they thought, oh, well, she's nearly finished. Half the book is there. So this severe heart attack at 69 produced in Jung an interior life which became even more vivid, with a series of visions which envisioned mystic marriages in three different cultures: the Kabbalistic mystic marriage, the Christian marriage of the Lamb, and the Greek Iliad, one of Zeus and Hera. And he says, at bottom, it was myself. I was the marriage. And for weeks, he didn't want to come back. And Barbara Hannah describes him telling her and Emma Jung that he felt his body had been dismembered, and that it had then been reassembled as in shamanic mode, and that he'd had to do most of the reassembly himself. So we've characterized this as a figure of the Wanjanas in Western Australia. It's rock art that could be up to 70,000 years old. It's iconic art of that place. And I just want to point out something really interesting in this image. Do you see the straight lines coming up out of the eyes, all around the eyes? In Aboriginal symbolism, that's the masculine. And the dots on the top in Aboriginal symbolism is the feminine. So, universal. Now, after the illness, he said, a period of fruitful work began for me, and a good many of my principal works were written only then. But he never fully recovered physically. And there's a letter that says, I will soon be 74. I have to tell myself twice a day, not too much. Snail's pace and rests in between, and a change of snail horses. I'm like an old car with 250,000 kilometers on its back that still can't shake off the memory of its 20 horsepower. So it didn't stop him. It didn't stop him. And the next image, we have him carving on stone in 1950s. He was 75 at this stage. And he carved on this stone three alchemical inscriptions, one of which says, here stands the mean, uncomely stone. 'Tis very cheap in price. The more it is despised by fools, the more loved by the wise. When I was working on the stone tablets, he wrote, I became aware of the fateful links between me and my ancestors. It has always seemed to me that I had to answer questions which fate had posed to my forefathers and which had not yet been answered, or as if I had to complete or perhaps continue things which previous ages had left unfinished. As there are not only the many but the few, somebody is entrusted with the job of looking ahead and talking of the things to be. That is partially my job, but I have to be careful not to destroy the things that are. Nobody will be so foolish as to destroy the foundations when he is adding an upper story to his house. So in all this, we meet the elder of the tribe, defining, adding to, and passing on a lineage of wisdom. And now the soul doctor diagnosed what he called an illness of our time, suppressed spirituality. He felt that this was the root cause of the midlife crisis, which he was the first one to identify, and that it was the core problem in all of his patients past the age of 35. And he said, "None is really cured who has not regained his religious attitude, which naturally has nothing to do with creeds or belonging to a church." So his attitude to the Christianity that he'd grown up in, and his father was a minister of the church, was that of a critical insider-outsider with a universal point of view. And he wrote, "I positively do not believe that Christianity is the only and the highest manifestation of the truth. There is at least as much truth in Buddhism and in other religions too. I only wish the theologians would accept the Kabbalah and China and India as well, so as to proclaim still more clearly how God reveals himself. If in the process Christianity would be relativized to a point, this would be for the greater glory of God and would do no harm to Christian doctrine." So what mattered to Jung was not what spiritual path a person walked, or what religion, if any, he belonged to. The crux was whether there was a conscious relationship with the source of all life, of all the religions, of all the many paths. And in his work, he helped people to the deepest level of whatever religion or path they were on. And this brings out one of his most powerful statements from his autobiography. "The decisive question for man is he related to something infinite or not? That is the telling question of his life. Only if we know that the thing which truly matters is the infinite, can we avoid fixing our interests upon futilities and upon all kinds of goals which are not of real importance. If we understand and feel that here in this life we already have a link with the infinite, desires and attitudes change. In the final analysis, we count for something only because of the essential we embody." Now, his own relationship with the infinite wasn't always easy and had a bit of double in it, as you might expect of him by now. So right from his teenage years, he used to challenge the prevailing attitude of his clergyman father, who used to say, "Oh, one ought not to think, but to believe." And the child would think, well, he was more than a child, he was a teenager by then, he would think his own thought, "No, one ought to experience and to know." It's the mystical disposition that seeks direct experience of reality rather than concepts about it. So it's not surprising that when British journalist James Freeman asked then 83-year-old Jung in a BBC interview if he believed in God, Jung made the famous reply, "I don't need to believe. I know." And that answer got him into a lot of controversy, not the first controversy of his life. In a letter to a viewer, he explained what that knowing meant in his life. "It is the experience of my will over against another and very often stronger will, crossing my path often with seemingly disastrous results, putting strange ideas into my head, and maneuvering my fate sometimes into most undesirable corners or giving it unexpected favorable twists outside my knowledge and my intention. The strange force against or for my conscious intention is well known to me. So I say, I know him. But if asked, why should you call this something God? I would ask, why not? It has always been called God." So at times in his life, he didn't submit completely to this larger than himself force, as in a dream he relates prior to writing Answer to Job, where he is led into the deepest inner sanctum and he bowed in reverence, but he kept his forehead just a millimeter from the floor. Something in me was saying, he wrote, all very well, but not entirely. Man always has some mental reservation, even in the face of divine decrees. Otherwise, where would be his freedom? And what would be the use of that freedom if it could not threaten him who threatens it? So one of his insights in answer to Job got him into deep trouble publicly. In answer to Job, he shocked theologians and critics when he wrote about divinity in manifestation as containing both light and darkness, a paradoxical light and darkness of relative good and relative evil, which is correspondingly echoed in human beings and thus forces us to face our own paradoxicality and to bring light and darkness in ourselves into a unity. Well, that brought a very hostile response from representatives of many religions, although it's an idea that's long held in Eastern religions. And American publishers were afraid to publish it for a while. And then when they did, they found it became a bestseller, as people who didn't know anything about the Bible were intrigued and wanted to know more about this answer to Job. So that's what publicity does for you. But you can hear Jung, this is one of his most personal books, and you can hear him having his own row with God in this book. And it's the yell of pain that says, why me? Or as he says in a letter, which I'll read in a minute, why should I be the unspeakable fool to jump into the cauldron? Because it cost him to do what he did. And it cost him to do what he felt impelled to do. And yet he couldn't stop because there was something bigger than that pushing him. So it's like the agony and ecstasy of life when it is fully felt. And in a long letter to the Reverend Erastus Evans, he explained this double relationship he had at times with the divine and its creative call to him. Allow me to tell you that I am profoundly grateful for your most remarkably objective review of my uncouth attempt to disturb the obnoxious somnolence of the guardians. That is the way in which this damnable little book looks to me. I can assure you I am a moral coward as long as possible. As a good little bourgeois citizen, I am lying low and concealed as deeply as possible, still shocked by the amount of indiscretions I have committed, swearing to myself there would be no more of it because I want peace and friendly neighbourhood and a good conscience and the sleep of the just. Why should I be the unspeakable fool to always jump into the cauldron? Well, I don't want to be melodramatic. This is just for your personal information. I have no merit and no proper guilt, since I got to it like a dog to a kick, as we say. And the little moral coward I am goes on whining, why should I be the one always that collects all available kicks? I tell you these things because you have been nice, just, and lenient with me. The attribute course is mild to what you feel when God dislocates your hip or when he slays the firstborn. That is one side of my experience with what is called God. Coarse is too weak a word for it. Crude, violent, cruel, bloody, hellish, demonic would be better. That I was not downright blasphemous, I owe to my domestication and polite cowardice. And at each step, I felt hindered by a beatific vision of which I'd better say nothing. So I don't know about anybody else in this room, whether anybody's had their own rows with God. I certainly have had mine. And I've been dragged kicking and screaming in some of the directions that I've traveled. So that was not to be left out. That's Jung at his most salty. So part of Jung's job was to remind us of a wider range of being, of a breadth and depth to be lived out, no matter what it costs. And in his scientific writing, Jung often speaks of the images and concepts of God we live with and their universal manifestations. But he distinguishes these from the nature of God, which he called the mystery of all mysteries and being beyond thought. And his overall relationship with God he captured unambiguously in a letter The divine presence is more than anything. I wanted the proof of a living spirit, and I got it. Don't ask at what a price. I don't want to prescribe a way for other people, because I know that my way has been prescribed to me by a hand far above my reach. I know it all sounds so damned grand. I am sorry that it does, but I don't mean it. It is grand. And I'm only trying to be a decent tool and don't feel grand at all. So Jung's vision, also in answer to Job, was essentially an evolutionary one in which creation is a continuous unfolding process and humanity is being developed to play a co-creation role with divinity. What was once called the Holy Ghost, he said, is an impelling force, creating wider consciousness and responsibility, and thus enriched cognition. The real history of the world seems to be the progressive incarnation of the deity. So it was in 1953 that Jung lost Toni Wolff, who died suddenly in her sleep, and then 2 years later, his wife Emma died. And in conversations with Lawrence Vanderpost, he called Emma the foundation of my house and Toni the fragrance of it. And letters in his 80s show he often felt lonely and misunderstood. I feel like an anachronism, he said, even to myself. And loneliness, he said, didn't come from having no people about, but from being unable to communicate things that seem important to oneself, or from holding certain views which others find inadmissible. Nevertheless, it was in that period that his autobiographical book, Memories, Dreams, Reflections, was published, and he worked on the only other book intended for the general public, Man and His Symbols, until 10 days before his death, when he completed his own contribution to it. So in the last years of his life, his letters show repeated concern for the earth, its future, and the individual's role in it. And he lamented what he called the general moral backwardness, which has failed to keep pace with scientific, technical, and social progress. And he posed the question whether human beings can resist the will to use the immense power of destruction given into our hands, or whether we can temper that will with love and wisdom. There's that awesome phrase of his, "The world today hangs by a thin thread," and that is the psyche of man. A change in the attitude of the individual can bring about the renewal in the spirit of the nation. And in a letter to Lawrence Vanderpost, he pointed to what he saw as a depth solution. "I cannot define for you what God is. I can only say that my work has proved empirically that the pattern of God exists in every man, and that this pattern has at its disposal the greatest of all his energies for transformation and transfiguration of his natural being. Not only the meaning of his life, but his renewal and his institutions depend on his conscious relationship with this pattern of his collective unconscious." So it was in this last decade that he released his controversial essay on synchronicity and took on scientific causality. It was a publication that was co-authored with Nobel Prize-winning physicist Wolfgang Pauli. And it was also then that his deepest work, the three-volume Mysterium Conjunctionis, was published, and he said it was met with stony incomprehension, at least for the time being. So like all his works, it had been incubating for decades. And in it, he synthesizes aspects common to alchemy, Gnosticism, Christian mythology and Indian tantrism through the symbol of the mystic marriage. So the first and second stages for the alchemist result in the oneness of mind and soul with the body. And the third and highest degree of conjunction was the union of the whole man with the eternal ground of all empirical being. This is a painting on cotton from Nepal from 1450, and it's Chakrasamvara, the dark unmanifest, with Vajravarahi is the light unmanifest, and symbolized in the union of male and female. And he said, this third degree of conjunction is universal. It is relation or identity of the personal with the suprapersonal Atman, and of the individual Tao with the universal Tao. It is the synthesis of the conscious and the unconscious. So in the last year of his life, he described himself as an 85-year-old ruin of a formerly capable man. And in an earlier letter, he wrote, this spectacle of old age would be unendurable. Did we not know that our psyche reaches into a region held captive neither by change in time nor by place? In that form of being, our birth is a death, and death a birth. About 3 weeks before his death, Jung received one of his last visitors, Miguel Serrano, who described him as dressed in a Japanese ceremonial gown, a Gnostic ring on his left hand, and Teilhard de Chardin's book, The Human Phenomenon, a great book, he said, by his side. And in that conversation, he said, today, no one pays attention to what lies behind words, to the basic ideas that are there. I have just finished reading a book by a Chinese Zen Buddhist, and it seemed to me that we were talking about the same thing, and that the only difference between us was that we gave different words to the same reality. And to a later visitor, Marie-Louise von Franz, he confided a vision that he'd had. I see enormous stretches devastated, enormous stretches of the earth, but thank God it's not the whole planet. Days before his death, he had a dream of a huge round block of stone sitting on a high plateau, its base engraved with the words, and this shall be a sign unto you of wholeness and oneness. At 4 p.m. on June the 6th, 1961, he died peacefully, surrounded by his family. In Memories, Dreams, Reflections, he made an assessment of his life. If I ask the value of my life, I can only measure myself against the centuries, and then I must say, yes, it means something. Measured by the ideas of today, it means nothing. And yet, as Jean Houston points out in her introduction in my book, Jung's influence can be seen in medicine, depth psychology, art, science, literature, the human potential movement as a bridge between East and West, and what she calls the North-South shamanic axis. So I close the book with the prologue of Jung's autobiography, which seems to sum up his story and all our stories. Life has always seemed to me like a plant that lives on its rhizome. Its true life is invisible, hidden in the rhizome. The part that appears above ground lasts only a single summer. Then it withers away, an ephemeral apparition. When we think of the unending growth and decay of life and civilization, we cannot escape the impression of absolute nullity. Yet I have never lost a sense of something that lives and endures underneath the eternal flux. What we see is the blossom, which passes. The rhizome remains. So Jung said of himself, I stand isolated between the faculties. And I would say, thank God for that. Surely Jung is a prototype of the way a strand of humanity is evolving across the faculties, across the cultures, to a universal sense of place, playing out our whole and unique selves from the inside out in the natural way, as spiritual and human beings in league with the source of all our lives, with or without that millimeter from the floor. Thank you so much.
And that is the end of the recording. This recording was made on DVD, and it included some images. The DVD is available in the library at the C.G. Jung Society, Seattle. The copyright is C.G. Jung Society, Seattle, and the speaker. All rights reserved. No copying, please.